Good morning. My name is Eric Peterson. I'm the Senior Vice President and Director of the Global Strategy Institute here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this session entitled The Future of the U.S. Military and Irregular Warfare. I'm delighted to tell you that I served on a committee that awarded Linda Robinson the 2004 Gerald R. Ford Journalism Prize for reporting on national defense, and it was through that connection that Linda and the concept for this event developed. And much of that is thanks to Linda's assistance in pulling together the conceptual framework for the distinguished panel from which we'll hear this morning. Now, every month here at CSIS, the Global Strategy Institute holds a forum to highlight an important issue on the long-term horizon. But clearly, the future of the U.S. military and irregular warfare fits into that mandate. And we are also grateful to be co-sponsoring this event today with the International Security Program here at CSIS, of whose ranks two are represented in the panel. Now, we are here today to pose this central question: what is irregular warfare, and is the U.S. military ready to embrace it? Now, I believe that question will occupy our panelists, and I will introduce them briefly now in order to get them off the ground in terms of addressing these and related issues. Now, as we've structured things, each panel will offer about 8 to 10 minutes of comments, and then we're looking forward to opening up for discussion in this expert audience here. Everything here is on the record, and the point here is to set the record straight. We ask that all those who intend to ask a question identify themselves and the organization with which they are affiliated. And please keep your remarks short so that we can have as intense an exchange as possible. Also, at this point, let me ask you to turn off any phones or cellular devices that may go off over the course of the presentations. Now, two introductions. Linda Robinson began her study of the Special Forces during a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard in 2000-2001 and subsequently began the reporting that resulted in, as you know, her best-selling book, Masters of Chaos, The Secret History of the Special Forces. Now, she covered Special Operation Forces in Operation Iraqi Freedom and was recently reported from Iraq and Afghanistan. She was senior editor at Foreign Affairs magazine before joining U.S. News and World Report, where she is now senior writer. Linda's book is available for purchase here, and I strongly encourage you to pick up a copy if you haven't already seen it. I'm sure our panelists will mention a bit more about Linda's book as well. Major General Joffrey Lambert looms large in Linda's book and in life, as you'll see, as a person with much insight into what the U.S. military can learn from the Special Forces and what the limitations for transferring those lessons may be, especially in the context of the global war on terror. Major General Lambert commanded U.S. Army Special Forces during Operation Enduring Freedom from the years 2001 to 2003. He subsequently became commandant of the Special Forces School, the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center School, position that he retired from in the year 2004. Major James Gravillis, who also shows up as a bigger-than-life figure in Linda's book, is a U.S. Army Special Forces officer currently assigned to the Joint Staff at the Pentagon. He served two tours of Operation Iraqi Freedom while assigned to the 5th Special Forces Group Airborne. In the latest issue of Foreign Policy, he authored an inspiring, eye-opening piece on one of his more memorable experiences in Iraq as the de facto mayor of Al-Rutba, where with only $3,000, he and a company of U.S. Special Forces soldiers established a nascent democracy in that city. Foreign Policy has generously made available a stack of copies of that magazine, which we have outside or in the back of the room available to you. If we run out of copies, I'm told that we can access this over online as well. My colleague Dan Benjamin is a senior fellow with the CSIS International Security Program. Many of you are familiar with Dan's acclaimed book, co-authored with Steve Simon, entitled The Age of Sacred Terror. Now, you are probably also familiar with a book that Steve Simon and Dan just released entitled The Next Attack, which is also available for purchase here today, which examines the evolution of the terrorist threat during the 9/11 period as well as the conduct of the war on terror in the intervening period. Now, prior to joining CSIS in January 2001, Dan Benjamin was a Jennings Randolph Senior Fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. From 1994 to 1999, he served on the National Security Council staff, prior to which he was NSC, 1998 to 1999, he was the NSC Director for Transnational Threats. In that context, his principal responsibilities were in the area of counterterrorism and included coordinating U.S. counterterrorism policy programs and budgets. We also have a few copies, Dan, of your other publications here today, as I understand. Finally, Clark Murdoch is senior advisor with the CSIS International Security Program. He is a very busy man indeed these days, including a major project that he is ramping up on U.S. Special Forces and Special Operations. Knowing Clark, he's already debriefed most of our panelists on this. In addition, he leads the project on nuclear issues, building a network of young professionals in the nuclear community. Most recently, he is the principal author of Improving the Practice of National Security Strategy, a New Approach for the Post-Cold War World, which synthesizes lessons learned for national security strategists and from the corporate strategy literature and post-Cold War case studies. And that is available also here. Clark is also the lead investigator of our Beyond Goldwater Nichols initiative here at CSIS. So with that, by way of introduction, I hope that you'll join me in welcoming this expert panel this morning for what I'm sure will be an extraordinary conversation.
Good morning. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you, Eric, for the introduction. And I'm delighted to have these colleagues here on a panel, and I want to give a special thanks to General Lambert because that was he was the key person that got me started on this venture because, of course, I could not get access to the Special Forces without the commander's permission to begin what's been about a four-year journey covering the not just Army Special Forces, but it began with Army Special Forces, and I've also been out with the U.S. Navy SEALs and the Air Force Special Operations as well. I'd like to start by giving a brief overview, a definition of irregular warfare, but I'm aware that each of these panelists has their own area of expertise. So I see my role here as giving kind of a tour of the waterfront and then letting each of them discuss their particular areas in greater depth. Irregular warfare, I believe, is a term that everyone will be hearing a lot more about in the months to come. It is officially enshrined as part of the Quadrennial Defense Review project. And there are also a number of efforts underway that I believe General Lambert's going to discuss within the defense establishment, including the among the Army and Marine Corps to define, as well as the Special Operations Command, to define exactly what is irregular warfare. It is not at the moment an accepted doctrinal term, but the general notion is that it defines what is the opposite of conventional warfare. One might also think of it as combining both insurgency and counterinsurgency. It is an attempt to look at the non-traditional modes of conducting war as opposed to traditional mass armored warfare. And I think the key element here is it's an attempt by the U.S. military to begin to grapple with exactly what it means to go up against networks of individuals, those who employ guerrilla tactics, and I think at its core also a kind of warfare that truly embraces the notion that it is the mindset of the target audience that is the true center of gravity. And that in turn begs the question of what forms of non-kinetic warfare must be used in to counter those types of adversaries. In a shorter form, I would say irregular warfare is simply what we've been engaged in Afghanistan and what we've been engaged in Iraq since at least June or August of 2003. My expertise has, of course, been in the special operations world, and I think that it is becoming widely recognized that these forces are particularly suited to the conduct of irregular warfare and this special type of combat. And that is because they are flat and flexible organizations who are highly trained. They have a lot of autonomy to adapt to conditions on the ground as the adversary's tactics evolve. And one of the mantras of the special operations community is that humans are more important than hardware, though it must be said that their abilities are critically enabled by mobility and technology platforms. For in the case of the Army Special Forces, their core unit is teams of 12 soldiers, generally the average age in their early 30s, and they're trained in a wide variety of specialties so that they can operate in a freestanding way. Just in the last few months, I've been reading a lot of memoirs of soldiers from the Special Operations Group in Vietnam, and it strikes me how little, in a way, has changed, despite the changes in technology and the fact that the Special Operations Forces are much, much better trained and equipped today than then. At its heart, there's still a great deal that they have in common with the people who served in MAC VSOG and the civilian irregular defense groups, because at the heart, these were teams, the recon teams in the case of MAC VSOG, were working leading Montagnards and other indigenous tribes in missions, including attacks on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And in the case of the civilian irregular defense groups, they were performing a more defensive function, but training up Montagnards and others, working hand in hand in some with these foreign, with these indigenous forces. The SEALs, the Navy SEALs, have begun getting into this as well, but I think that the key point I want you to take away here is that I think that the key special operations skill for this kind of warfare is their people skills. And as General Lambert likes to say, those who have an affinity for eating goat with hair on it. It really takes a type of soldier who's comfortable getting out and living with the natives. There is another aspect with this population-centered type of warfare. It takes an individual who is acutely aware of the impact of killing, the boomerang effects of killing. And in every instance, at least in my experience, there was a premium placed on attempting to avoid that kinetic approach. If there was a non-kinetic approach that would solve the problem, that was what they went for. I just spoke within the last couple of weeks with one of the soldiers who is in the book. He's now back stateside. He's been on three tours over in Iraq, and he had, just in a casual conversation, a few points struck me. He noted how the flashbang grenades, when they have to do a hard entry into a house, he said if they land near someone, it can burst their eardrums. He was acutely aware of the effect on children and parents when they have to do raids in houses. And he told me one anecdote where he was sent with his team, along with the Iraqi counter-terrorist force, into a house in Baghdad, and they had to do a hard entry because they suspected that some of the insurgents were there in that house. They got into the house. The head of the house said, "Oh, you're looking for Hamid. This is his house, but he doesn't live here. Three times now you've come looking for us." And this Special Forces officer was so upset at the impact that they were having on this family that he went back to his commander and said, "We have got to find a way to develop a database so that we know all the other units that are going in to a given area, a way to coordinate and have a database where we know if a house has already been hit by another unit, not Special Forces unit, some other unit, we will be able to access that and know." So I think this is just a small, very anecdotal demonstration, but it's that kind of awareness that I think is really key to this kind of warfare. The people skills that I mentioned, some people feel they stand in kind of a stark contrast to the unilateral commando skills. But in fact, this individual that I just mentioned, he's been trained in the direct action skills. He was among the special forces, part of units that were traditionally oriented toward direct action missions. And yet his, I think, primary emphasis was how to at least minimize the impact on the population of their operations, or at best, how to win over the population, even when they were operating in a commando role. I also had the opportunity early this year to go out with the Iraqi counterterrorist force, and not with this individual. They were then being mentored by another unit of the special forces. And I was quite impressed by the degree to which the special forces soldiers, the Americans, were not in the lead. They were very much in that mentoring, coaching function. And this, it's now the Iraqi Special Operations Forces. It's a brigade-sized element, and they're able to plan and conduct their own operations. They are still dependent on support and the logistics tail for on the U.S. military, but they have come a long way, and I was able to go out on a raid with them one night and witness the degree to which they're able to perform, and they took the imagery of the target, did their own concept of operations, built a terrain map, briefed back to the special forces commanders, and with just a few tweaks on the plan, they were ready to go. And being out there in the field, I was also able to see that the special forces soldiers truly did trust these individuals with their lives. And since I've just read these Vietnam memoirs, I'm very struck by the fact that that is really what you have to do in this kind of warfare. It is not really a lip service when you talk about coalition support or joining with foreign forces in some kind of diplomatic, cosmetic way. They are there shoulder to shoulder in the trenches. Just briefly, I'd like to address the higher level of the debate here. I think that in the case of the use of SOF in Iraq and in these other venues, there's a tension because they do have a capability to train and work with indigenous forces. Right now they're being employed to some extent in the training of the Iraqi security forces. They have also, however, been one of the key elements to gather intelligence for the counter-guerrilla raids. So there is a natural tension over what is the best use of this, as they call it, high-demand, low-density asset. I think that there is a general lip service being paid now by everyone to the principles of counterinsurgency, but I have come to conclude that in the case of Iraq, there is still not the central emphasis placed on the non-combat and non-kinetic aspects of counterinsurgency. And that is, in the case of the purely military, it is building up, as I mentioned, this logistical tail, the ministerial defense, Ministry of Defense, Ministry of Interior, but it also includes the governance piece, the civilian government, the power, the water, the oil production. And these things are very much part of a counterinsurgency since it affects the population, which is the center of gravity. And I think that there is, my conclusion is that despite a lot of lip service being paid to this, it is not being given the primacy in the strategy. And there is also a problem with the home front, which is the other center of gravity, that the strategy has not been clearly articulated and benchmarks given and progress reports given, because I think we've all seen the slide in the public opinion polls, which is fairly recent and can be turned around. That is my view, but not if you don't place this population front also at the center of your strategy. In terms of the overall irregular warfare debate, the way I see this shaping up is in requiring three major steps. The Special Operations Forces do need to grow. They need to be increased and supplied with the technology to enable them to take on their missions, which are largely in the irregular warfare arena. They can only grow so fast, but the growth must be, a premium must be placed on that. Secondly, the conventional military needs to embrace as many of these tasks as it can handle. And in some cases, missions can be handed off to conventional forces or even assumed by them at the outset. And I think that one of the key areas where military, conventional military capabilities need to grow is the foreign area officers. Cultural and linguistic background is key to this kind of warfare. There are also certain mission sets that are being considered within this basket for the conventional forces to embrace, and that is missions and to grow, to have more emphasis given on those. Non-combat evacuation operations, counterinsurgency, demining, expeditionary air traffic control, personal security detail, explosive ordnance disposal, combat aerial delivery, anti-terrorism and force protection, interrogators, maritime interdiction ops, quick reaction forces, human intelligence, signals intelligence, search and rescue capabilities, and military working dogs. These areas certainly overlap with the SOF missions and capabilities, but in this case, redundancy seems to be a wise thing when one is talking about a generational effort and the fact that many adversaries choose irregular warfare as their mode of confrontation. And finally, I think that this QDR process hopefully will result in an enshrining of irregular warfare as a mission, not just that the military leadership embraces and therefore dedicates the resources to, but also the emphasis on the interagency nature of this kind of warfare and a concomitant commitment on the non-defense parts of the government to grow those capabilities. And within the State Department, I think that is where it is most notable in terms of reconstruction and stabilization, USAID, and similar capabilities. And finally, I think there is an emphasis on moving forward with detailed interagency plans, and some are supposed to be forthcoming at the beginning of the year. So I think in the next quarter we'll be able to see just how far this project of irregular warfare will advance. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you, Linda. Now it's with pleasure that I introduce Major General Jeffrey Lambert.
Yes, thanks a lot.
Yep, we'll get it going right away.
How do I do that?
Here.
Is it up there?
Yep. Okay. I've got somebody standing by if you want to click.
Yeah, there's somebody could do that.
Yep, I'm sure.
Listen, I can't do two things at once. I can't walk and chew bubble gum and all that. George, you know the deal. Here, you want to use this thing? Huh? Okay. Well, anyway. All right, I'll start. Hey, just go to the next slide, will you? We'll get going here. Hey, there's good news regarding the war on terror. I mean, it's all over the place. I went back to my small town in Kansas. We did take down the single stoplight we had, and it's true. And the one restaurant that's open about 4 days a week, and we sat down with the old vets in there and we solved all the problems. So I'm going to give you some of their thoughts here, and I did this last weekend. But really, we drew these conclusions, and it's very interesting. I think one of the messages is we punished ourselves enough for being in rectal defilade before 9/11 and immediately thereafter, and that we ought to get on with business and get on with winning the war. But anyway, I think I'm very optimistic. Next. You know, it's like boxing. You know, the memory from your old boxing coach, you know, if you're really hurt, the guy really hits you hard, then recover a little bit. You're still fighting, but recover and then go back into the attack. But if you don't do that and you start wailing away, you know, sometimes you'll make a mistake and leave yourself vulnerable because you're still recovering. Well, after 9/11, that's what we did. We reacted like we should. When soldiers and statesmen are under stress, they do what they're trained to do, and that's deploy joint task force and go kick the enemy. And that's what we did. After we recovered a little bit after 9/11. Next slide, please. The nuanced warfare comes from Linda's book. It tickled me no end when she said this is a more nuanced form of warfare. So just thought I'd gig her a little bit here and title all these slides Nuanced Warfare. But anyway, I like it. We need another word to define, another term to define, I think, in D.C. But anyway, so Joint Task Force took off. And now after several years of doing that, we've got an appreciation of the irregular warfare. You're here as part of it. And we're starting to understand the nuances of this new way of fighting. Next. You know, Thomas Friedman kind of hit it way back when in one of his articles when he said that Muslims policing themselves is really the key to winning this thing. And that stuck with me all the way through here, and I thought he was on it. If you really look at this, it's more than that. I think the broader blinding flash of the obvious is that allied and coalition partners police themselves the way to win the Quad. And we're not the only one with a threat to our way of life from this disease. It's much larger than that. And then if you look at the top bullet up there, you know, that all these folks are doing some really good work, and they've done it lately. The Australian incident, and it got press for about 3 seconds, you know, in the United States. But these are major victories that are occurring all around the world, and we need to look at this as an allied and coalition partner business. Next. Another wonderful thing alluded to in Linda's book, and Jim over here will talk about it, one of my old soldiers here in a minute, is that the triangle's acknowledged now. You know, in wargaming now, you don't just have red against blue forces. You don't even have that at the national training centers anymore. You have civilians on the battlefield with their own interests. And they can be neutral, or they can be pro the red side, the bad guys. But they're out there now. It's recognized. This has always been part of insurgency stuff for centuries. But now it's mainstream. And this is really, really a good story, a good news story for all of us. Human rights, everything involved in this. This is wonderful. It brings it all forward. Now, next slide, please. And strategies are starting to address the triangle. It's in our strategies now. And really, if you know, the thing is, you have to separate the bad guys from the civilian population. And so this is wonderful news. So we're moving down this trail rapidly. Next, please. I think that this is the revolution of military affairs. Everyone, you know, for a while there, a lot of folks thought it was technology. It's not. This is it. I told a fellow this about 3 years ago, and he said, "Can I steal it?" And I said, "Sure." And he ran with it and made some money with it. But this is it. And what you do is, I think, is that you plan separating the bad fellows from the civilians as the onset, you know, and then you also plan striking and killing the bad guys too, and then you work them together. And this is where you get your newest form of warfare out of it. Next, better said, is probably that the revolution in military affairs is that you write the non-kinetic plan first, and then the military supports it with the kinetic plan. And this brings about enlightened war fighting. And I drew these triangles, and I did this when I was the J3 of SOCOM about, 9 years ago for a class for the SOIO folks, if anybody remembers them or not. And we played a game with this and had lots of fun with it. So this is something to think about. Next. But the RMA's bigger. Now, you've seen this picture laying around here. This was first put together about 1993, this picture, because of the failure to plan for occupation in Panama. Till the last second. So the phase four business. So the regional equilibrium came from a professor at the Army War College. If you know what regional equilibrium you want, then you can plan backwards. And the battle space box in the middle is where fighting goes on. Intense fighting goes on. But if you know what you want, then you can plan all the way backwards to it, and maybe you can come up with these non-kinetic and kinetic combination of strategies and stuff like that to see to plan towards the future. It's also known as phase zero now, a little bit, prevention. So one of the key buzzes here today is, I've been pushing this for a while, is that prevention beats preemption every time. When you have to do a preemptive op, the question should be, why did we not prevent it? Ask that question, figure out what we did wrong, and then go back to the table for the next round. Anyway, then at the bottom there, as time moves this way, irregular warfare is unbounded. War is now unbounded. Maybe war is the wrong word. Maybe it's conflict. I don't know. But it's unbounded, and it's unbounded in time, tactics, and space. This type of war, it can strike in hometown Kansas, all the way to Singapore, all the way to downtown China, to Spain, to England, to whatever. It's unbounded. So this thing about going off to a theater of war and fighting over there and somehow winning is different. And we've got to figure this out. It's all changed. Next slide, please. I got to speed up. Anyway, there's great debate whether manhunt or draining the swamp's better. Manhunt's easy. You bring heads home on sticks, you know, and makes us feel good, and it's U.S.-centric, okay? But also draining the swamp, you know, that lots of folks have said, Mike Sheehan is one of them. Drying up the swamp where this evil stuff grows is hard, and it's like kissing your sister. I did that for my sister, if she gets to see this. She was a Navy officer. She will be upset. But the better one, it's a non-manly approach to war, and my daughter's in the Middle East now, so I want to hear from her on that one, too. I put them up for my family. Next slide. I'll speed up here. So we need both. You know, Decapitation does help. It isn't bad. It's not a bad thing. It's a mandatory component of this kind of strategy. But draining the swamp is also the way to put the whole thing to bed over time. And capacity building, indirect approach to war, solid allies, coalition partners are very important. Next. So I read the national security intel strategy, the national intel strategy, looked at it, said, yep, address both. Gets thumbs up here. It does address both. Fine. Next. The litmus test even got better on number 6 of the enterprise objectives. Listen to this. Establish new and strengthen existing foreign intelligence relationships to help meet global security challenges. In other words, we're not in this alone. It's a global informational intelligence grid. If you don't build that in this type of war, you're bounded. So we have to get that unbounded. So this is wonderful stuff here. And then I like anticipation in the strategic objectives. You anticipate problems and take action to prevent them. It's kind of in there, so thumbs up on this document. Next. Why dwell on intelligence? When I was a private in the Army in 1969, the 4 F's, find the enemy, fix him, fight him, and finish back then had 4 letters in it, and it's changed over time. Now it's finish. But anyway, the 4 F's are still there. They're out and about in the beltway now, so let's go on. Next. Okay, why do you spend your $1 you have on intelligence? Because it's a find war. Everybody knows that too. It's in the press. This is a find war. Next. So pick a column. Where are you going to invest your $1 next? Well, you can see where you invest it, except for one problem. DOD can't totally convert to this. We've got to retain our ability to fight conventional wars. So you can't switch the entire investment, and this is what the rub's all about here in the city. Next. So ask for help. And we will. Next. Okay. I'll sum this up. It's not guns or butter. It's intelligence and allies or butter, or maybe a combination of both. But we don't have to bankrupt ourselves to win this war is the message. These joint combined fusion centers that are dotting the globe now are the way to win. I had a friend in Ecuador a bazillion years ago who said, I don't know what to do with this crisis. I said, it's real easy. Build a fusion center in Quito. Everybody's always built a fusion center. Well, it works. So you build a fusion center. Everybody comes and talks, and you start passing around information. You find a solution. I mean, this is good news. This was in the paper about 3 days ago about this, and I'll leave the subject alone. I won't talk too much. But it works. Anyway, there is an issue with U.S. national will here, and the protracted struggle in Afghanistan and Iraq bothers me. But I think it just complicates the principal reason we will win. And the reason we will win is it's not our war. It's everybody's war. It's Jordan's. It's Thailand's. It's Indonesia's. It's Malaysia's. It's Australia's. The Philippines, Saudi Arabia, Egypt. How many do you want? So we must make this, make sure the world joins us, and we join the world, and we can win this thing. Next. Now, reinforcing fires. All you old artillerymen out there, you have direct artillery support, you have general support, and reinforcing is that extra stuff that's not shooting somewhere else that you get. So I found some here. That was from Bruce Hoffman in front of the House. He said that we ought to maybe look a little bit more at the global counterinsurgency aspects than capture and kill. Next one was our weakness is clear in deny, defeat, diminish, and defend. It's in diminish, which is draining the swamp. Then we need twos that he spoke to, separating the enemy from the people. So he's honoring the triangle. This is all good stuff. Capacity building for other nations to take this fight on. Good stuff. So it just made me feel like I was on track putting this together. Next slide. Okay, so why will we win the next one? And you hit me when I'm too long here. But anyway, we'll see it coming in the informational grid. We'll move to prevent it with capacity building and partners. This is my I Have a Dream slide, by the way. Okay. With global coalitions, we'll have an interagency team that functions, that give unvarnished advice to the senior leaders. The targets might be economic and psychological, with small military action to support them, maybe. Let's find it. We'll cease mirror imaging. We'll honor the triangle I just talked about. But listen to this. Dimes big in the city, right? Huh? Diplomatic, right? Informational, military, and economic power. We'll combine all those together. But who's talking about combining them as allied power instead of just U.S.? So we say that we're not going to mirror image. When we come up with a solution, we talk about what we're going to do. So the mirror imaging just continues. It isn't dime, it's international dime, okay? So help me with that one and push that noodle around the town here and we'll get that thing going a little bit. Anyway, we'll have reasoned debate, we'll be patient, and heck, even long-range planning's taking place all around the city now, and I mean, this is all so good, I just can't believe it, you know? I mean, wish I wouldn't left the Army now. Next. Blinding flash to the obvious number 2. Dig out the old Nixon doctrine, read it, update it, and you just about have your strategy. It's not hard to do. This thing worked great. This is one of the best things that ever happened in my business. Wonderful stuff. It's really called the Guam Doctrine, though, but it wasn't catchy enough, so they called it the Nixon Doctrine after a while. Next. Anyway, finally, I'm down to the two things I was asked to do. Define irregular warfare. Well, Glenn Harned is a bright guy over at Booz Allen Hamilton, and he's working with the Marine Corps and with Special Operations in MacDill and with OSD SOC to try to define it. And this is one of the, and I don't know what the services or the SOF and the Marines have decided, but early on, I like this one as a start. It's a philosophy. I really like that. And it's to accomplish your strategic objectives without engaging heavily in the conventional warfighting arena. It's not bad. It's a place to start as you're putting it together. I'm not sure where it'll end. The services will get a vote here. Next. Now, this is really the answer. Is the military ready for regular warfare? Boy, this was tough, so I had to scratch my head on this. And I said, gosh. All right. Informational grid, unlimited information. We're investing all that money in intelligence right now. We've got it. We've got that part. We're understanding. So the grid will move us to interagency and joint combined operations that move from being reactive and preventive to and preemptive to being preventive. Now, so the subject here is I think the comprehension of joint force requirements, structure, and methodology to be the most effective in prevention while retaining world-class conventional warfighting skills is the issue. And I think that's what DoD is going to struggle with when it comes to irregular war. Because prevention's new to most people. Some of us it isn't. So that's my shot. Okay, next I'll wind up. Okay, I'm almost done. Next. Anyway, it's not rocket science. Someone has to be in charge. People are working on the NSC. We've got to have great information. Intelligence overhaul is underway. We got to recognize that unilateral solutions are old think, and we're starting to think and act and build globally. Information age, we're in it. Strat communications coming along, starting to grind, move. PSYOP is in there too. And then finally, we got to enable our partners and capacity buildings out on the street, so it's all good. Next. If I was going to build a quad chart for DoD, I'd just put those four in there and say, look at this one for a while. You know, capacity building, intelligence, global fusion, and IO and PSYOP. Maybe that's a way you can get somewhere. Next. Finally, what keeps me awake at night? I'm so optimistic. Something worries me. It's the national will. It really does. That can throw us off. It threw us off before, and I'll end with that. But that really bothers me. And who is simply watching and waiting and letting the fires burn out there, but they're planning great acts of evil later, and they're letting us exhaust ourselves? Bothers me. So we're still fighting, but we can recover a little bit now, and then we can move out in this more global direction, I think. I think it'll happen. I think it's got impetus. It's a snowball starting to roll off the mountain, so I'm just kind of reporting on that. But getting the world to join us is key, and we'll join them, and I think we can take this thing on. Next slide here. A real funny one. Really not funny, but odd. McPherson College in 1968, I had this discussion with my history professor. You know, there was a war going on back in the 60s, and it was, what's one of the phase down steps that you might do? Well, they were big secure bases where we did all these things for the host nation, but let them start picking up the burden of the war, and we did that, but we stayed. And then we turned turnkey operation where we turned over that infrastructure that we built up to them for the future and all that. So, you know, there's nothing new. You know, there's really nothing new. Timetable back then was when the military says it's right, our military, and the other timetable, well, listen to this, was when the host nation determines that they have the will to take it, and then we'll figure it out. So it's just all coming back. Next. So, but don't get stuck on stupid. Russ Honore said that. I know he's probably sorry he did, but he said it so I can use it. He was an old friend of mine. But, you know, after Vietnam, we castrated the CIA. Huh? We took all the guts out of security assistance, the Harrington Amendment and everything else, choked ourselves out, almost couldn't do business around the world. It was safe to invest in the Cold War, but there wasn't anything else. There was none of that loose stuff around anymore. And don't get confused. This is my final slide. You know, there's a global war on terrorism going on. And every time I pick up something around the beltway here, there's all this good happening, which makes me think there's some common wisdom in place or something. Some systems are functioning enough to understand that there's a global war on terrorism that we ought to win. So I'm just saying, as we slug it out and we all get parochial and go for the jugular because the elections are coming up in 2006 and all that type of stuff, we ought to stay on target. What I'm trying to say, because I watched a spin off a target one time, and I don't want us to do it again. I don't know, have all the solutions or anything. Anyway, that's it.
General,
all right, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't spend a few minutes.
Now it's with pleasure that I introduce Major James Gervilis. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for that kind introduction, and thanks for the invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here. Before I begin, I just want to make sure everyone understands that these comments are my own, and they don't reflect any policy or position of DOD or the U.S. government. So with that out of the way, what I want to talk about is our special operations capabilities from a ground perspective, and I'll try to bring out some of the lessons learned that we're experiencing out in the field. I want to make it very clear that I'm convinced that we have the most capable special operations forces in the world right now. I can't make that more clear, and I say that for a number of different reasons. First, there's no other force that can transform itself so rapidly and so frequently and still remain effective on the battlefield. And to give you an example, our teams that were conducting guerrilla warfare in the mountains of Afghanistan in a matter of months turned into and generated a mobility force that was able to do scud hunting in the western deserts of Iraq. And then in a matter of months, when that mission was over, in a matter of months, they again changed their mission focus, their equipment sets, their individual skill sets, and they began doing urban counterinsurgency in the Sunni Triangle. And that kind of change and that ability to change so completely and so quickly makes special operations forces very powerful and very useful in today's battlefield. The second reason is because special operations forces have immense conventional capabilities. And I'll use, again, our example from the Western Desert. We used speed, mobility, long-range communications. We were armed to the teeth. We integrated air power. And we were able, this handful of ODAs, this handful of teams, was able to create the battlefield effects of a large conventional force in that area. And I'll give you a very clear and simple example. There were over 1,000 Iraqi forces on H-3 airfield, and I applied three ODAs to that airfield. And in a little more than a week, those 36 men were able to dislodge that entrenched Iraqi force, regular army force, that were in bunkers and in buildings and had large ADA pieces. Air defense artillery pieces. And so that's just an example of how small, soft tactical units can have strategic effects in an effects-based warfare. Third, special operations forces have amazing operational agility. There's no other force that really can go from the range of tasks that soft can go to. And I'm not just talking about conventional military tasks like interdiction to assaults, but I'm talking about from the conventional task to the unconventional, and to integrate civil affairs and psychological operations into their attacks and their ambushes. And I'll give you a very clear example from one of our detachments. They were attacked from an enemy strong point on the outskirts of the city of Arupa. And they defeated that enemy. They overran the enemy's position, and they came across this huge warehouse of munitions and guns and food. And that team automatically began distributing the food to the locals in the city. And they brought up a loudspeaker team from our PSYOPS detachment. They began playing music, and they began mingling with the locals in that city. And this is before we could enter the city. And the Saddam Fedayeen still had control of the city. In the outskirts of the town, they really started a block party. And about 300 locals came up. They handed our guys a CD because they wanted to hear some traditional Arab music, and our guys played their music for them. And they stayed there and distributed this entire warehouse of food out to the locals, and then they packed up the munitions and the weapons, moved them out of the city, destroyed them, and then continued on with their patrol. And it's that ability, not just to be able to react to fluid situations, but to shape those fluid situations and develop the activities on the ground. And I'll give you another clear example, too, of what I'm talking about. And I encourage everyone to read the article that's on the table there in Foreign Policy. There's a lot more details than I can go into now. But what our company had to do was go from firefights, from intense military operations, to civil administration and reconstruction overnight. And we didn't reorganize, we didn't retrain, we didn't retool our company. We moved into the city the next morning, and we began establishing a police force, getting essential services running again, opening the banks, passing out humanitarian rations, and our ODAs were able to do this without skipping a beat. And it's that kind of operational follow-through that you don't find in other elements. And part of that, a big part of that, is the language skills, the cross-cultural skills that special operations have. But another main reason that SOF have that follow-through is because they always focus on the population. It's ingrained in our doctrine that we leverage the indigenous capabilities. And so we keep a population as a center of gravity all the time, and we understand that there are political aspects, there are psychological aspects and human factors that are involved in warfare. And so another thing that we're finding out in the field is that the more self-sufficient a unit is, the more effective it is at combating terrorists and insurgents. In a decentralized fight, like counterinsurgency, like low-intensity conflicts, what we need are very flexible, very capable, and very autonomous small units. And our special operations forces are the best, the most self-sufficient, and the best small units we have in the military. And because they're the best small units, they are the ideal force for finding and destroying a decentralized, cellular, and networked enemy. And so the last thing I'm going to make a point about is that these capabilities are not just at the operational detachments. Over the years, we've built the intelligence, the logistics, the air support needed to field large SOF forces, large armies of SOF forces. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Is our combined Joint Special Operations Task Force in Iraq demonstrated their ability to direct large-scale, countrywide special operations in support of a conventional campaign plan during OIF. But what's even more telling and sometimes not recognized is in Afghanistan, our Special Operations Command demonstrated its ability to independently run and manage a major theater of war. And they did that in a landlocked country on the enemy's home turf. They did it on the other side of the planet. And that itself clearly illustrates the magnitude of the Special Operations capabilities that we have developed over the years. And so I'm not going to talk anymore. I'll save the rest for a question and answer period. But thanks for that, for your attention.
Jim, thank you very much. Thank you. Over to, if you'd like to stay where you are, that's fine too. Over to colleague Dan Benjamin.
Eric, thanks for the introduction. I hope you don't mind if I stay seated. We analysts, we can't stand next to the soft guys, so we'll just remain where we are. I want to thank Linda as well for her remarks, and particularly for her book, which is not only filled with great yarns, but with really fine writing, and that's always something that deserves recognition. When I was in the government, I had the privilege to work with introduced to me as the operator community, and it was really one of the high points of my experience. And I thought that maybe I would give a little historical note on where we were then, where we are now, and how there are lessons in that transition. In the late 90s, it was quite a curious time. We found that we had super trained, super capable soft forces, and yet we had a military culture actually that was quite averse to using those forces, particularly in missions other than in support of combat. And I think that anyone who was in the national security establishment at that time will remember the acute frustrations of the political leadership in actually getting SOF operations launched. And Bosnia is one particular reference there. There were some others involved in counterterrorism operations. There was a real reluctance on the part of senior military leadership to see SOF troops used, and there was a sense that and I think this was a sense that hung over DOD really from the time of Desert One, that high-risk operations were just something that people didn't want to get into. Well, let me just add as a footnote there, we don't usually talk about our failures as scholars and applicants for grants, but Eric may recall that Edward Luttwak and I actually spring and summer of 2001, decided that we needed to do a project on the bureaucratics of special operations and what we could do to organize things so that there would be a greater willingness to use these terrific assets. And the postulated threat was jihadist terrorists. This was, as I said, spring and summer of 2001. And the universal reaction was terrorism isn't a threat and SOF isn't going anywhere. So what a difference a catastrophe can make. It seems to me that for the time being, we've solved the issue of the bureaucratics, and I applaud the emphasis that DOD has put on SOF and deploying it and using it in a wise and I think appropriate way for the most time. Now I think what we need to worry about is the pendulum overswinging. There is a tendency in the post-Afghanistan period to see special operations as a panacea and as the thing that's going to make our military invincible in all situations. And I'd like to suggest that we need to be very careful the way we situate SOF in the war on terror. And here I think I want to sort of second the remarks of General Lambert. I think we're going to say this somewhat differently, but I think we're probably in the same place. What is it that special operations is going to do in the war on terror? I'm concerned that we have tended to over-militarize the war on terror, and that we think that all operations are going to involve door kickers. And the fact is that that is going to be true in some regions, usually poorly policed, poorly governed areas, whether in Southeast Asia, in Afghanistan, perhaps in parts of Iraq, but that by and large the terrorist threat is not one that is going to be confronted first and foremost by special operations. Now, I do think that there's an absolutely essential role, and I think that the Pentagon is appropriately emphasizing this in the training mission. And I couldn't agree with General Moore about getting others to fight this war with us. And my argument has been if this isn't at a minimum a Western project and really a global project, then we're going to be in very deep trouble because we can't do it alone. And we can't do it in countries that we don't know nearly as well as the indigenous forces. But at the same time, I think that an awful lot of the counterterrorism missions we're going to encounter are going to be carried on by intelligence forces or intelligence operators who are working in liaison with local services and who are able to carry out the kind of long-term missions and the careful surveillance over great periods of time that we don't expect special operators to undertake. So, you know, I'm concerned right now by the extent to which there's this belief in Washington that the war on terror is first and foremost a military mission, and it seems to me that in embracing that we may be missing some of the key tools we need both for draining the swamps and for finding the bad guys. Let me close on one last note. The general spoke about national will. The pendulum has swung in one direction. It will swing back again, and I think we can see some of this beginning to happen now. And the reason is that there is a problem in a large democracy in conducting irregular warfare because it doesn't really comport with our instinctive understanding of what a war is. And Tocqueville mentioned this, you know, in the 1830s, that when America gets into a war, it'll be very late to get in, but it will get in with both feet and wholeheartedly and use every asset at its disposal. Irregular warfare tends to be of a different nature and tends to be behind the scenes, and this causes a great deal of anxiety in a society that is deeply sensitive about issues of transparency and how the war is going to be conducted. And it seems to me that we are going to need a lot of missions from special operations, and we are going to be involved in a fair amount of irregular warfare. And what that requires is a certain amount of public education about what it is that these missions are undertaking, what the level of oversight is, the extent to which these are being vouchsafed by a bipartisan national security establishment in the Congress and in the community at large. That's really all I have to say, but I do think that we do need to keep an eye on where our special operations endeavors fit into our larger culture of national security.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. And now over to Clark Murdoch. Clark?
I, too, will sit here because you've heard from four experts, and then there's me. When I was first asked, actually by Linda, about 4 weeks ago, to participate in this panel, the first thing I had was, why me? I haven't really worked on special operations and haven't really worked in a regular warfare. I've done it in the context of larger assessments of the nature of the security environment, the kind of demands are being put on it. But then, in sort of a reflection of how entrepreneurial we are here at CSIS, I now appear before you as the new project co-director for the project on special operations and special operations forces. A couple of my colleagues are hawking books. I'll hawk a project and an emphasis here at CSIS that's right now being headed by somebody who has an awful lot to learn, is on the steep edge of the learning curve. But I do believe we bring some strengths to this. And one of the things in particular is that I've been working very hard over the last 2 years on what we call the Beyond Goldwater Nichols series of initiatives, where we're looking at trying to identify problems on how the United States government and how the Department of Defense is organized to address public problems. And it's clear to me that there's a need now for a Beyond Cohen Nunn, that special operations were formed about the same time as the original Goldwater Nichols. They were to meet the needs of a different security environment. We're now clearly, from public reporting, at a stage where there's a lot of roles and missions issues internal to the special operations community, but also a lot of roles and missions issues with respect to relative divisions of responsibility between the special operations community and the conventional community. At first blush, when I was trying to put together a prospectus to meet with our donor, Tom O'Gara, who's the one that's kicked off this project with initial funding, I was sort of saying, well, what is the debate between the need for more special operations forces and making our conventional forces more soft-like? Well, I quickly learned that there wasn't really a debate between them. We need to do both. There's just no question about it. The demand for special operations capabilities vastly exceeds the supply. As Michael Vickers has recently testified, you know, over 90% of our deployed soft assets are now in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Yet we're engaged in a global insurgency in which there are Al-Qaeda-associated cells in 60 countries and Islamic insurgencies in 20 of them. With this kind of mismatch between the demand for special operations capabilities and what we have to supply, we have some very substantial thinking to do on sort of coming up with intergovernmental, U.S. government-wide concepts of operation and how to deal with this and how we're going to structure ourselves to do it. Another strength that I think CSIS brings to this table is we do a lot of work at sort of the strategy level, grand strategy level, and the national policy level. And yet in my very brief introduction to much of the literature, there seems to be a focus on sort of the tactical up to the operational level. And I think that this is an area, again, where we need to step back and look at it from a broader perspective, because I think we have gone through a paradigm shift. Dan has just mentioned one paradigm shift from the pre-9/11 to the post-9/11. Pre-9/11, terrorism's not important, although there was a lot of lip service given to it. It wasn't until the actual event happened that people took ownership of the problem, and the demand for soft wasn't taken seriously until post-9/11. I think we've gone through another paradigm shift, and we see that in two of the original presentations on irregular warfare. This is not just a war on terrorism or a terrorist entity. This is a global insurgency of related, you know, metastasizing and related and associated cells that have to be dealt with on a distributed, networked, small unit basis. And I think, again, as we go into this paradigm shift, and we've coined the phrase irregular warfare to sort of capture that, because it's elements of all different kinds of warfare, from insurgency to counterterrorism and so on. So anyway, I'll be mercifully brief since I'm the last speaker and I know the least about the subject, but to say maybe in a year I'll know a lot more. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've had a number of interesting perspectives and points here this morning. We're beholden to all the panelists for their thoughtful comments. Now it's your turn to engage on these. We are now soliciting feedback and reactions. Please recall that we'd like you to identify yourself and your organization. And if possible, could you please address your question or your comments to specific members of this panel? So in the back, please.
My name is David DeRoche, and in this forum, I identify myself as a former U.S. SOCOM staff officer. I kind of thought I came into the wrong seminar today because I thought it was irregular warfare, and all I heard was soft, soft, soft. And Eric, unfortunately, in your remarks, you described General Lambert's post at the JFK School as head of the Special Forces Training Center. So what I'd like to ask about is the non-kinetic soft, and particularly, does anybody believe that we can win irregular war just with SOF, and what is the appropriate balance? Can we, you know, is this focus on SOF actually dysfunctional? Does it lead to a pigeonholing of this mission among the bulk of our conventional military establishment, which just says, oh yeah, that's a SOF mission, we don't have to deal with it?
Thank you. Who would like to take that one on? Linda?
Okay. Sure. I'll make a few comments. I am sorry that you came away with the impression that it's all about SOF, because in fact it is about migrating SOF capabilities over to the conventional military, at least insofar as that is an appropriate shift. I think there's a common sense that there are some missions that the special forces units in especially high threat environments, denied territory, that they're going to be the ones that will continue to do that. But there is a whole gamut, and what I'd like to just put in here also a comment about the concern that Dan mentioned about the overuse of SOF. If you think of SOF really as the manhunting capability, then you miss the point here. It's really about their ability to work with foreign forces. Well, guess what? Conventional forces can do that too, and particularly in certain environments. And I think that's what we're looking toward is out of the QDR process and the various discussions going on to have the big army and the conventional forces generally embrace irregular warfare as one of their key mission sets and reorient so you have more troops that have training. There was a recent Wall Street Journal article about FAO, foreign area officers, up in northern Iraq. So I think that is the kind of asset that needs to have a lot more resources devoted to it, and the missions in general of training and advising, mentoring, coalition support. Those are all things that need to be emphasized. And I also would like to comment on Jim Fallow's article in Atlantic Monthly, where he pointed out that the mission that General Petraeus had and now General Martin Dempsey has over in Iraq of training the Iraqi security forces was traditionally not a mission held in high esteem within the regular army. And I would say that is, I don't know if that is correct, but I would certainly say that's where the high profile rising stars need to be, is in those kinds of missions.
General Lambert?
It's not about SOF, it's about strategy and how you articulate that strategy globally, and how what roles the regional component commanders, or whatever their name is now, geographical component commanders, whatever, and how they articulate that to their subordinate units and how they execute it. That's what I spoke to. I barely mentioned SOF in my briefing. So it's not all about SOF. And here's another one just to throw out for just to chew on a little bit. What happens if we're out of Iraq in 3 years and Afghanistan stable? What happens? What's operational tempo then? Where's the next big invasion that's going to tie down the U.S. Army and the Marine Corps? I want you to tell me where that's going to be. So what problems are we solving today while we're hand-wringing around here? I'm just saying to take a little bit of a longer look at this war and figure out what we really need to do, develop a strategy and figure out how it's really going to be played out, and then sign missions accordingly to people that can do them. That's all.
Jim.
Sure. It just so happens that our soft forces have been developed to be experts at irregular warfare. Since 1952, the intent behind the Green Berets was to be able to leverage the military potential and population bases. And so we've developed this entire branch, and it's not just Army Special Operations, it's all the special operations, it's civil affairs, it's the psychological operations, it's that whole aspect that we have focused on in the soft community. So we have resident experts that have studied it, that have experienced it, that have fought in El Salvador, that have fought in Vietnam, that are instructors now. And so we have this huge intellectual capacity to understand and wage irregular warfare. And it just so happens that that resides in the soft community. So the idea is, how do we get those experts and how do we spread that expertise around? But at a very basic level and practical level, our soft forces, because of their unique capabilities, are bridges for a lot of the different elements that must be brought together to conduct successful counterinsurgency. An example is that our teams are the unique force that can link local forces, local civilians, can link conventional forces, can link our coalition partners, can link the intelligence community and law enforcement agencies. Our soft, because of their paramilitary and military qualities, can bridge the gaps between these different agencies and really generate a complementary effort. So I hope that answers your question.
Right here, please. Wait for the microphone, would you?
Bill Courtney with Computer Sciences Corporation. To what extent will the Army Future Combat Systems Program be helpful in irregular warfare?
I don't know the program. I really don't.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to put that one in abeyance then until our next session. That will be an issue to take on. Please, go ahead.
Well, I'll take that on in that they need to be enabled and are, in fact, I think, being enabled by some of the very same technologies that have been developed out of SOCOM, which has a rapid acquisition authority. And I think that's something you see when you go out to the field now, operating with NODs. I don't think they've migrated over the embedded radio systems yet, but I think all of those communications devices are key, the ability to operate at night, and the kind of close quarters combat training. And a lot of but I think my emphasis and what I've seen out there is it's really more than technology dependent, and I think that's partly why none of us is prepared to really comment on the relevance of the future combat systems. I mean, yes, you need small size units able to communicate with each other and operate out in the field. This is a vision of warfare that is much less technology dependent in effect. It's talking about training up the kind of soft skills, the linguistic training, the cultural area study. So I think while there is a technology component to it, the emphasis really is on the other side of the coin.
Please. Wait, Laura. Yeah, there we go.
Harlan Ullman, CSIS. First, the panel, thank you very much. This was a very, very useful discussion. I have three brief questions. First, General Lambert, you're absolutely right that it's imperative to set your outcomes and then work backwards. But how do you ensure that future presidents, vice presidents, secretaries in defense, and chairman of joint chiefs are going to do that? Second, it seems to me that we have a huge problem strategically and politically in Iraq, the 80-20 problem, 80% are Kurds and Shia, 20% are Sunnis. Whether that becomes intractable or not, I don't know. To what degree do military forces have a role in dealing with that huge political imbalance? And finally, on the global war on terror, it's my view that most other countries do not share our passion and concern on the magnitude of the danger. Now, if that is correct and there's this huge asymmetry, are we right? Are they right? And if we are right, how do we get the other people to support our thinking?
Harlan, I'm not sure I agree with you that fully on the last point. I think that among elites and among governments, and especially among intelligence services, there is a more agreed upon threat perception now than there has ever been. It's not perfect. But it's closer to being uniform than anything we've seen in the past. I think that one of the problems we find is that in the particular political environment, I'm going to try and say this delicately, in the particular political environment we're in, there's not a big desire to voice agreement over that threat perception, and there are political pressures from below that lead leaders to try to soft pedal it sometimes. So in the effort that many leaderships are doing is to continue to wage the war on terror in a fairly a quiet, if not to say clandestine, way. We know that all the intelligence services of the world are working quite hard on this, or most of them, but they don't want to yet go before, that is, the leaders don't want to go before their peoples and say, this threatens our nation in a very primal way, in many cases because they don't want to sign onto an American worldview. And I think that one of the ways in which we will shape the environment of the future is to make it clear that our worldviews regarding the threat are not that different, and encourage them to be more forthright in saying that.
I'd like to reinforce what Dan said on that and amplify it just a little bit. I agree. I think there is a much broader agreement on the threat of posed by al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-associated cells in this global insurgency that we're caught in. But it is a low-level insurgency, not low intensity, because as many have pointed out, there's nothing, no lack of intensity on many of these specific engagements. But it is low-level and compared to major combat operations. And I refer back to the point that General Lambert made. If Afghanistan were stable and we're out of Iraq in 3 years, or if we hadn't gone into Iraq in the first place, we would be at a different level of activity right now. We would still be fighting a war on terrorism. We would still be engaged in the global terror, you know, the global insurgency, but the level of activity would be distributed, much of it covert, much of it clandestine, much of it below the fold in terms of press coverage. And I think for Americans, when their will to persist in a conflict really comes into question when it's protracted and seen as unsuccessful, not when it's protracted and seen as being successful. And so it's Iraq, not necessarily our ability to persist, are in the terms of American ability to persist in the war on terrorism.
Let's move along here. 80-20 and political willingness. Are there any other comments on the first two questions?
This probably won't be of quality, but the old El Sal bunch got together a while back here and talked about things. We tried to figure out why it worked so well and it lasted so long. I mean, our first concepts we wrote in 79, and I think, if I recall, I got a message from a buddy in the embassy that I had forgotten worked there, and I got it at Fort Devens, Massachusetts. He mailed it to me or something and congratulated us on the end, you know. So, I mean, it went forever. And I think it's understanding that there's a common problem. A lot of folks don't realize that President Carter made that decision in December before he left the office to go ahead and pick that ball up to try to build a democracy in El Salvador and change it from a history of brutal military dictatorships. And he boldly made that decision, and then President Reagan didn't have to. And I think it's just, and then policy was pretty clear and everyone got on board, and it was to stabilize the region, don't let any more countries fall, and try to turn the Sandinista thing around at the same time. But they had a regional focus and everything, and it was leadership. So I think if we all understand that there's a problem, there's consensus in the American people's minds that there's a problem, and that the folks on the Hill understand that there's a problem, that you get some sort of continuity and longevity over that transcends party differences and things like that, because it's a good thing to do to put this threat to bed. I think it might get wings. I'm not sure. But you're right, it's always a problem when administrations change.
Right here, please, in the front.
Thank you. Yanis Popescu from CSIS. Most of the panelists agree that the conventional forces must become more soft-like, and at the same time, Major Gavrilli said that the soft forces actually become a lot more conventional-like in the sense that they are now able to draw upon a huge amount of firepower in conflict through Air Force and so on. So I'm wondering, because we're planning for the future operations, how helpful is it still to think that you're going to have separate conventional war versus the regular war or disruptive threats or the other threats that are in that quad chart?
Who would like to respond to that? Thanks.
I think I can. I think the most important difference is the mindset. And really what is critical is not necessarily the specific skills or tasks that each type of force has, but it's a mental agility to be able to shift from the different tasks, to be able to shift from a warfighting task to a nation-building task, and understand that, okay, the center of gravity for the conflict may have been the forces, Iraqi forces, for instance, and Baghdad, for instance. But then once that changed, then the center of gravity was the Iraqi people. And there was an element of a popular liberation. And there's an element of revolutionary warfare. And it's that kind of shift to be able to take your mindset off of the forces, and once they leave, to shift it back onto the real political purposes that you have there. And if you look at, what do the individuals in that society need to change their political nature? And it's an introduction of democracy, and it's fair elections, and it's these kinds of things. And so it's the mental agility to be able to shift from what the political objectives are and to be able to go through those intermediate goals and get to the political objectives through the military objectives. So I hope that answers your question a little bit.
In the front, right here, please. Right there.
Thank you very much. Brigadier General Sikorsky, Defense Attaché of Poland. I would like to make a points, and if you could
just keep it short.
That's right, very, very short points. The first thing, I think, key issue is to separate enemy from people. I do not know how you manage this, but it's not easy at both strategic and tactical level. We do not necessarily agree worldwide who really sometimes the enemy is. It's one point. It leads me to the other point. In this case, perhaps the easier way would be to support allies, and coalition partners to fight terrorism and, on their own, at their territory, because they may better understand a situation. And this, perhaps, it will be more effective than developing own forces to send them somewhere to the other places. The third point would be, and it brings me that perhaps we would think not only about allied nations or coalition partners, perhaps we would focus as well on improving capabilities of countries which may become or already are a safe haven of terrorism. Thank you very much.
I think it's important to make a distinction. In irregular warfare, you can't really separate the enemy from the people, because in a large sense they're partisan soldiers. They're part-time soldiers, and they have regular civilian jobs, and it's really a large segment of the society that is taking arms up. And so what becomes more important is separating the leadership from the population, those critical individuals that can motivate and mobilize segments of the population. And it's also important to separate the external support mechanisms and the external factors from that population base. And so you don't try to separate the individuals from insurgents, because a lot of times they're the same thing. But what you do is you separate the leaders and the external support structures and the psychological factors that drive them to pick up arms. And so it's a much more nuanced kind of warfare. So that's the first part. I don't know if anyone wants to answer that
part. Please, General.
Very quickly. I was at the University of California, Santa Barbara in 1982, walking through the library, and there was this dusty old book, which always fascinates me. I pulled it down, and it was the British Constabulary Record of Police Actions in India from 1910 to 1946. So, of course, I sat down and immediately started flipping through that thing. They were decapitating Nehru's movement from about 1917 on, and they'd take and put folks in jail and take away the leadership. and it was a great technique for stalling it and slowing it down, but never eradicated it. You can't win with it, but it sure had value. So what he said on my left here, on the left flank here, is exactly right, is you can do that, but the key is eventually then to solve the basic underlying problems that caused them to join in the first place, and that's how you buy the time to do it.
Okay, fair enough. Let's have another question right here, please.
Peter Sharfman, Miter Corporation. If we have to think that a target of the enemy is the mindset of the American people, it seems to me a reasonable generation that the American people don't like long conflicts in which it's hard to measure progress. So it's not just an irregular war. The Korean War got very unpopular when it reached the point that you couldn't say each month the enemy is noticeably weaker than they were last month, and we can demonstrate it. And you have that problem now in Iraq. It's not that it's that the people really have no idea whether we're winning or losing, and no idea what would constitute real evidence one way or the other. So this is really a question, I think, for Clark, who's embarking on a strategic look at irregular warfare, which is how are we going to explain this in a more effective and more compelling way to the American population without whose support the government cannot possibly succeed?
Since it's addressed to me, I think I'll take the first crack at it, no matter how inadequate it may be. My own feeling, as I stated before, is that the American people don't ask for things, you know, what are your five measures of effectiveness? And can you give me a grade each month? They form their impressions, you know, based upon what is the daily feed to them as it accumulates over time. They make their judgments about whether their leaders seem to know what they're doing, whether the leaders seem to have some sense of purpose to their activities, or whether their leaders are being pushed by events. And if the events are going in a negative direction, as in, you know, lots and lots of effort, but very little decline in the number of incidents that are happening on a daily basis. We live in a CNN world, and so the immediacy of the conflict is apparent to all. So the Americans think we're on a declining right now because of what they sense that we're on a declining path. From a strategic perspective, I would argue that one of the things that any practitioner of national security, and this is very inside the beltway kind of formulation, has to be very careful about are mistakes of commission in this business, because the big mistakes really hurt you when things go wrong. Because if you make a big mistake, as I would argue we've made in Iraq, the repercussions of that undercut your ability to operate, one's ability as a national decision maker to operate in many different areas. And you know, Iraq has become one of the central fronts in our war on terrorism now. But the war on terrorism is the enduring war. And that insurgency is an enduring insurgency. And I would argue that the overfocus on Iraq and Afghanistan, but Iraq in particular, has undercut our ability to operate effectively elsewhere. So one of the things, as you look at this from a strategic perspective, is don't make big mistakes. You know, it's a simple thing, but don't make big mistakes.
Would anyone turn it out to me? Please.
No, Peter, I think you're absolutely right, and that was in part why I made that remark earlier about this is not the American way of war, and it we do require both a sensitivity towards, you know, American instincts about these things, but also you know, a recognition of what the limits are in terms of public will. I think this is one of the reasons why capacity building all around the world is so vitally important, because the ability to train and help guide other countries as they carry out both military and intelligence missions against terrorists, you know, if that happens, that's going to be, I think, largely unobjectionable to the American public, and in fact, it's going to be seen to be a sign of common cause. But if we are wheeling out the heavy armor in a situation like Iraq, where frankly wheeling out the heavy armor does exactly what our friend from Poland argued or indicated, which is it actually drives the people and the enemy closer because of the sense of grievance from having lots of civilian deaths, from being occupied, from what have you, I think it's a self-defeating thing. So to that extent, I do think that special operations has a very good future, as does intelligence liaison, but it has to be done carefully. Otherwise, we'll have blowback from, you know, concerns over human rights and that whole raft of issues.
Sure.
I just think that there is too much focus on tactical engagements, and really that's where the media's attention is, and it hasn't been on the real political developments and a real community building that is occurring around the country. And when we went into the city of Arupa, that first day, I began working with those local Iraqis to help improve the community. And I was convinced at that point in time that we really had done the right thing and that we were doing the right things and we were there for the right reasons. And so what we found, and this is what I'd say is important, is what we found was that the Iraqi people responded to good governance more than they responded to democracy. And what I found was that's what was missing under Saddam, and they really needed some kind of polity that took care of the individuals and that could take care of their citizens. And it's those kinds of developments that are most important in that region, and it's those kinds of developments that are most important, that underlying strategy. Those are the most important factors, and we're just not seeing those. And so I would submit that we need to focus more on those political developments, and that should be enough in a lot of ways to gain more support, because they're really improving a lot of Iraqis' lives. And I think that's the most important factor there.
All right. Well, with that, our time is running short. Would you like to add anything before we go? I was thinking maybe...
Sure, I'll just make a last comment because I'm again struck by some of the initial questions, and I just wanted to underline that I think that the important point is a question, is the military going to embrace regular warfare as a critical mission? And that it means at a strategic level, it also filters down to things like doctrine and manuals and really training individuals to be able to step up to the plate on this. I saw troops out in coast in Afghanistan, conventional troops, learning on the job, trying to tackle this, and a lot of them have done very well. There are now rotations at the National Training Center emphasizing civilians on the battlefield. General Corelli took his first cavalry division to Austin to learn about city management, administrative tasks, and really emphasized that during his tour. The Marines are taking on the training of foreign military tasks. They are going to join the Special Operations Command. But these are all just examples of anecdotal ways in which elements of the military, I think, are embracing it. Artillery units have been turned over into MPs. But what I think is needed is really the overall embrace of this project as something enduring going forward.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's clear to me that we could carry forward this discussion, but unfortunately our time has ended here. I would like to thank Clark Murdoch, Dan Benjamin, Major James Garvillis, Major General Jeffrey Lambert, and in particular, Linda Robinson, whose efforts help inspire and guide us conceptually here, for an outstanding session. Would you please join me in thanking them for their comments?